This sermon was recorded at Christ Church Overland Park, a congregation that seeks to be a people fully alive in God's kingdom.
So Amanda referred to it earlier. This is not a light passage, and no, it was not my choice. See, here's my theory. The clergy are sitting in a room a couple months ago, planning the sermons. Patrick, Amanda, Dean, Trish, and they're going through the passage. Okay, who wants the Beatitudes? Oh, yeah, I'll take the Beatitudes. Okay, who's going to take salt and light? I'll take that. Who's going to take this one? And like blank stares. Let's give it to Derek. So that it's a heavy passage. Not only is there a lot in the passage, it's a big passage, but there's a lot of heavy themes. At first blush, it sounds a little bit like the most recent episode of WWE. We've got fire, eye gouging, lust, and adultery. I mean, so that's prime time right there, I think, right? So I want to simplify it a little bit, though, and I want to ask kind of a couple of big questions of the text and ask, what's the driving idea behind these four portions? So our one big text breaks apart into four smaller texts, and they each follow this same pattern. You've heard that it was said to those of old, but I say to you. And these four texts, these four passages, all serve the same purpose. Jesus is answering the question that he raised in the section just prior. He foresees the Pharisees and the scribes wondering, what is Jesus' relationship to the law of Israel? And so if you think about how Matthew has presented Jesus through the book of Matthew up to this point, he's showing how Jesus perfectly fulfills all that Israel did, but now Jesus is presented as the true, the better, the new Israel. And think where Jesus goes to give the Sermon on the Mount. He goes up on the mountain, and if you were a Jewish person, you associate going up on the mountain to receive the law. But instead of going up and receiving a law, Jesus turns and gives them a law. Think about the words that he begins with, blessed. The Psalm 119 that was our reading today, is 176 verses. It's a massive love song to the law, to the Torah. It says, blessed are all those whose way is blameless. And throughout that psalm, it's blessed are those who keep his precepts. Blessed are those who do all the things commanded in the law. And so already Jesus is challenging who really are blessed. And then he talks about light. And that was actually a metaphor used in the Old Testament four different times for Israel. Israel was supposed to be the light to the nations. But Israel, in their sin and their idolatry, failed in their calling to be the light to the nations. So Jesus is basically saying, I've come to begin a new people. And so the scribes and Pharisees are on alert. He's announcing the gospel of his kingdom. By gospel of the kingdom, just as review, he's not necessarily meaning the kingdom that will come. He's saying heaven, which exists now, which is God's dwelling place, and which will exist forever, that the economy of heaven, the way of life that exists in heaven, the priorities of heaven, Jesus has come to bring and to form a people who have that life among them. So when he says, that the kingdom is drawing near, he's saying the life that is reserved for God in the Trinity is coming near so that you can now participate in the Godhead, in the life of heaven. So there's this overlap between what will be and what is now. And the question in this text, and this is really the question I want to ask, and then I'm going to make a couple observations, is what and how, really a question, how does Jesus define righteousness? If you were a scribe and a Pharisee, that's an important word for you. There's this idea in ancient Israel of a tzaddik. A tzaddik was a righteous one. To be a tzaddik, you kept the law perfectly. You knew the law perfectly. You had the law memorized. Every one of your steps was dictated by the law, and you did everything in your power to not break the law. And thus, you were a tzaddik, a righteous one. So in Jesus' kingdom, who are the tzaddik? And I want to start, it's going to feel like it's out of left field, but I'm going to start with a political philosopher from the 17th century, Thomas Hobbes. Try to stick with me. I hope this works. So, Thomas Hobbes is best known for the idea of the social contract. You've maybe heard of it. It goes something like this. By nature, and this is Hobbes' view, by nature, we are inherently selfish. That every single decision human beings make are for their own good. He called it egoism, psychological egoism. He said, because of psychological egoism, if we lived in what he calls a state of nature, and by a state of nature, he means a society not governed by laws. So you take people who are inherently selfish, you put them in a society with no laws. He says the inevitable outcome would be we would eat and devour each other and rip out each other's hair and do things that they do on WWE. I really don't watch it, just in case you're concerned. That's what would happen. So therefore, man decided, hey, this isn't good. So caveman A is sitting in the cave next to caveman B. Caveman B has made a pot of stew, and he's eating his stew, and caveman A is hungry, and he says, stew good. And so he takes his hammer, and he pounds caveman B on the head and takes his stew, because that's the state of nature. Well, then caveman C sees it, and he says, I want that stew too. And he knocks caveman A, and he takes his stew. And so the cavemen decide, hey, if we keep knocking each other on the head, this is never going to end. So let's make a contract. Let's decide that even though we should get to do whatever we want, because there's no laws, let's make a contract where we will provide for each other certain restrictions so that we protect our greater freedom. And this is basically what Hobbes means by the social contract. You give up some rights to protect what would, in essence, be more significant rights. Therefore, in that scheme, law simply becomes the thing that keeps you from doing what is harmful to another. And you could, if your law was simplistic enough, you could say, I have kept the law perfectly. I have not murdered. I have not committed adultery. I have not borne false witness in court. I have been just. And that's the kind of what I'm driving to with this analogy, is to be just in that system. And in the Hebrew and in the Greek, the word for just is the exact same word as righteous. They're used interchangeably, same word. So to be righteous, to give someone what you owe them, is all we mean when we say something's just or not just. That to be just is to act in accordance with the law. And that was the same view that the Pharisees adopted. The Pharisees took the law of Moses, and they saw it as a list of restrictions of the things I can't do to my neighbor, but anything not listed or any loophole I can find to get around what is listed is fair game. That's what the true idea of legalism, that's what legalism is. It's defining a righteousness based on not just performance of law, but with law as the literal law being the standard. So Jesus confronts the Pharisees. In the last verse of last week's passage, so Dean focused on the top half. The second half of last week's passage says a couple important things, and we're not going to understand this week's passage unless we refer back to him, so I'm going to do it real quick. Jesus says this, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, I've come to fulfill them." And then, explaining this further, he says that the righteousness of his disciples will actually exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And now we get these four statements. "You have heard that it was said," and this is the law that the scribes and Pharisees ascribe to, "but now I say to you." So Jesus confronts their legalistic idea of righteousness as law being the restrictions of things I don't do to you, and as long as I don't do those things, we're good. I have no further obligations to you. If I don't murder you, I have no further obligation. But Jesus says that's in fact extraordinarily far from the heart of the law. So what is true righteousness? What is righteousness in Jesus' kingdom? So first thing I want to say about righteousness is the nature of righteousness. What is the nature of righteousness in the kingdom of heaven? Hobbes suggested that the only reason laws exist, like we said before, is because of our egoism, our obligation, and our devotion to self. And if that were true, there would be no deeper principle underlying a law. It would only reflect your own good that you wished to have protected. But Jesus flips that around. So let's take murder as an example, and I think we could do this with all four of these portions. There's not going to be time to dig into each of them, but let's use murder as a test case. If I murder, what am I doing? I'm acting in hostility against a person for their destruction. I'm seeking to gain something for myself by taking their life. That something for myself could just as well be psychological. So I'm not saying you kill someone to get something, but it might be the psychological good of vengeance or the supposed good of vengeance. You take in order to get. In the same way, however, isn't the same exact principle operating when I'm angry with a person? In my anger, I might call them a fool. I might say raka. It was just a common word that probably meant something like blockhead, idiot, numbskull. When I say that, I assume an antagonistic and hostile posture against that person. And hear that preposition, against. I am seeking to gain some sense of satisfaction, of self-worth in that moment when I call them fool, not by taking their life, but by taking their dignity. What lies behind this principle is the reality that not only has God not created us to be takers, but he's actually created us to be the opposite, to be givers. Theologians, in large part, agree with Hobbes with regard to our sinful state. Original sin has distorted us so that we're born into this world with an orientation toward ourself. St. Augustine used the Latin phrase incurvatus in se, bent in upon ourselves. He said that's what we enter the world as. And what he means is we are self-focused, self-concerned. That's our orientation. But Jesus said the righteousness of his kingdom seeks to undo the bend, to bend us away from ourself to the other. Jesus doesn't just say, don't be against your neighbor. The true meaning, the true principle that lies deep behind that is you were created and have always been created to be for your neighbor. We don't just exist in this space individually, autonomously doing our own things, minding our own business. When God placed Adam and Eve in the garden, he gave them a command, and the command was serve and keep. Lovingly give of yourself for the good of my creation. That we exist not to please our sensual appetites, not to build just lives for ourselves, kind of minding our own business, not doing bad things to others along the way, because that's what Hobbes wanted, right? Hey, just don't kill me and we're good. Don't steal my stuff. Jesus says our obligation is not just to myself, but when I enter a space and I share it with a person, maybe that person is my wife, maybe that person is my children, maybe that person is my neighbor, maybe that person is my coworker. At that moment that I am now assuming that space with them, I have an obligation to that person to seek their good with as much intensity and desire as I would seek my very own good. And anything less than that is to not give my neighbor what I owe them. Romans 13:8 captures this idea. It says, owe no one anything except to love each other. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. Henry Scougal was a 17th century pastor, and I came across this a couple weeks ago. This is his picture of love. And listen in his description of love, how love at its heart, love at its core is an orientation away from self. It's a self-forgetfulness. It's a willingness to stop thinking about my needs and focus on the good of the other. He says this, perfect love is a kind of self-dereliction, a wandering out of ourselves. It is a kind of voluntary death wherein the lover dies to himself and all his own interest, not thinking of them nor caring for them anymore, and minding nothing but how he may please and gratify the party whom he loves. I think what we realize immediately when we stop and think about that picture of love is that what Jesus means by love isn't an emotion. It's not a list of things to do. It's a disposition toward a person for their good. But when I read that Scougal phrase, I think, what if that existed in a community? What if there was a community of people where that degree of love really existed, that degree of self-forgetfulness, the willingness to forego a wrong done to yourself, the willingness to love a person given their faults? I mean, think how often. So I went on a silent retreat a month or so ago. And I was silent for 3 days over the weekend. And one of the things I did, at that point I knew that I was going to be looking at this sermon this week. And I decided to just pray through the passage. And I asked myself the question, who have I murdered? Who has my heart assumed a posture of antagonism against? Who have I called a fool? And I just started confessing names. And before long, I think I had probably confessed every single person I have ever shared a space with. Whether it was a simple thought, well, they're wrong. How could they think that? To something more intense, I can't stand this person. But that self-reflection, and here's where I want to go with this. So I don't say this to say, hey, let's just go around beating ourselves over the head, realizing, hey, we're all murderers and we should all go around feeling horrible about ourselves because of it. What that did, it actually had the exact opposite effect. It made me want, made me desire, Lord, what if you were able to cultivate in my heart a greater gentleness to my coworkers, a more sincere patience with my children, a willingness to not immediately assume I'm right when I'm in the room with someone who has a different opinion. And what we realize when we take Jesus's idea of righteousness really seriously, he's not asking us to give up anything. Jesus is inviting us to learn to experience in our hearts and in our families and in our marriages and in our workplaces and in our church the life of heaven. The kingdom of heaven has drawn near. So when Jesus goes around preaching that message, he's inviting his listeners to act on his words. And he uses really strong language to say, this isn't a light decision. This is weighty. This is heavy. This is so valuable that you ought to be willing to chop off your hand to have it. But it is. If, in fact, by heaven we mean a world populated by those who share the character and the life and the love of Christ our Savior, then I can't think of a more blessed way to go about life here and now than inviting that life into my heart. I'm going to close with this. How do we do that? How do we invite the life of Jesus into our heart? In Matthew 4, when Jesus is going through Galilee, he's healing people. And as he's healing people and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, crowds begin to gather. And it says that they brought to him all the sick, and Jesus was healing them. Here's what I think Jesus is doing when he's healing. He's bringing goodness, but what he's doing, he's saying what the kingdom is about. The kingdom is about the restoration of our brokenness. It's going to start with the physical. We've got leprosy. Jesus says, I will restore that. But then he comes up on the mountain, and in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, but really, guys, we've got a far greater brokenness, far greater leprosy that we have to deal with. And I've come not to replace the law, but as the fulfillment of the law, to do what the law could not do. I've come to bring wholeness. I've come to bring restoration. I've come to bring you back into relationship with the Trinity. And so The question then I think Jesus might be asking is, do you want to be healed? And I think what he wants us to do is come to him and say, yes. Jesus, I believe that the kind of healing that you want to bring, this complete renovation of my heart and my soul, is good. And I trust that in your goodness and in your power, you will do this. You know, Jesus says that it's hard to enter the kingdom of heaven. That always troubled me. Why does he say it's hard? Doesn't that kind of like go against everything else the New Testament says about entering the kingdom of heaven? The Pharisees made it hard. Did Jesus make it hard? I think I finally realized what he means, and it's because we have two different kinds of hard. There's the kind of hard that's getting a perfect score on the ACT. That's hard. It requires a degree of intelligence. It requires a degree of devotion. There's the kind of hard that's climbing a mountain or running a marathon. It's excruciating. But then there's the kind of hard that asks you to move to a new state or say goodbye to a close friend. To join Jesus' kingdom is hard because it says you're geared to think your happiness depends on the satisfaction of your desires. But it's not. You will actually be more blessed in my kingdom when you learn to orient yourself outward to the other. Let's pray.